Welcome back to Define the Relationship Podcast. Today's episode is a real treat. We get to listen to our conversation with Elaine Entz and Ched Myers, authors of Healing Haunted Histories. We have been using their book as a guide for our exploration into our own healing and the healing of our lands and peoples, indigenous peoples and ancestors. And it's a great conversation. Mm-hmm. Hey, Ted?
Yeah, it was really good. And they were in costume.
Yeah.
We were not. It's a really, really good get into hearing about themselves and the work and giving us tons of wisdom to guide us in this process. So
I'm excited for them to join us on Sunday. So enjoy the podcast. Welcome to Ched and Elaine. We're excited to have a conversation with you. A lot of our community that is taking the course has been diving into your book at various levels. And that's been exciting to see. And of course, Ted and I have been, I've been immersed in the book for a couple of years, actually. So, but the chance to be able to talk to you guys is really beneficial. And I think just to start, to let our community hear a bit more about you, tell us a little bit about, how you came to this work that you do. And, you know, maybe I always think about Krista Tippett. I don't know if you ever listened to On Being, but she pretty much asks every guest to, you know, kind of describe their spiritual background, your spiritual landscape. Just introduce yourselves a little bit and tell us a bit about that.
Thank you. Well, it is really great to be with you and look very forward to seeing everyone on Sunday, where we get to talk together. Ched and I are beaming in from the Ventura River watershed, which is in Southern California. This is where we live and work on unceded and untreated Chumash land. And of course, that's a legacy of genocidal colonization that Ched and I feel accountable to. I grew up in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, so very close to where you all are, relatively speaking. And I grew up, like some of you, I would imagine this sounds familiar. I grew up in a tight-knit Mennonite community and family, 50 first cousins, and now, of course, that family has expanded greatly. And when I think about my formation, or even my spiritual formation, and how to do this work, there's a whole bunch of stepping stones, and I outline some of them in the book. But four quickly come to mind. And you know, the first one was 105 years ago in December, 1918. My maternal grandmother, she was 14 years old, and she endured a home invasion in Ostrovik, Ukraine. And this was during the Russian Revolution. Anarchist soldiers commandeered the house, and so for 2 weeks. And so she and her girl cousins were hid upstairs in the attic. And my great grandmother, who was 46 years old, she fed and bandaged and provided hospitality to these soldiers. And if you know the Mennonite history of the 1920s, the folks that came in the 1920s, that was just one very small episode in a continuous climate of violence. And so when I was 13, I knew that something horrible had happened to my grandma. and I wanted to learn more about it. And so I interviewed her, and she spoke about the beauty and abundance in Ukraine and how beautiful it was to live there. But as her narrative approached her teenage years, she began to cry. And she could not continue. And, you know, later I realized, you know, this is a part of the trauma that she endured, and kind of the unresolved maybe trauma, which has been intergenerational in my family. And then the third would be in my final year of college in Winnipeg. I volunteered with the Big Sisters, Little Sisters program. And I was paired with a 13-year-old Cree girl. And I am forever grateful for that gift. Of course, I didn't realize it at the time, but now she led me on this whole journey. So she'd just been released from juvenile detention, was in a lockup facility. And her crimes were things that I now realize, or, you know, much later realize they were a reaction to the, race, economic issues, cultural issues that she was facing, and that the criminal justice system was unable to address what she needed. And so that is what spurred me on to go on Mennonite voluntary service, to work with the victim offender program, and really led me on this whole journey. And then the last thing I want to say was that my family was involved in the 60s scoop, and a beloved aunt and uncle adopted two Cree boys, one of whom, Larry, is 6 months older than me. So I grew up with Larry and Glenn. My aunt and uncle were given no cultural training or understanding to help raise these boys. And of course, none of us in the extended family were having any of these considerations. And so, you know, one of the hauntings that I feel is that I just had no idea of what my cousins, who Larry and I were buddies when we were little, you know, I just had no idea what they were going through, what they were trying to metabolize in this very large settler Mennonite family. And then, of course, in a dominant white farming community. So those are four things from my childhood that I feel really compelled me and shaped and misshaped me in this journey of trying to understand my discipleship of decolonization.
Wow. Thanks, Elaine. I just before we moved to Ched, I wanted to say, well, two things. So I've heard you say a few things in June in when we took this class with you guys. And I think when you shared the stuff about your grandmother, that's when I realized, oh, Elaine, I want to be your friend. I feel like our grandmothers, you know, had the same stories. It felt like I could have just taken that page and put it on my page with a few variations. But yeah. And this is something I want to put a pin in maybe, but when you said the phrase, I had no idea what Larry was metabolizing. I think last week we had part of our conversation was about, you know, dealing with the moves to innocence and how I didn't know, you know, is both true. It's sometimes like, right, you're saying like, we had no idea. But the way in which you told that story was not in any way a move to innocence on your part. You said, you said, I had no idea about these dynamics. It was about reflecting on what Larry was, what his story, what his experiences are. And I think we were kind of struggling a little bit with how to talk about that when something is true that we didn't know.
And not just using it as an excuse.
And then I just thought, like, when you were sharing that, the way you shared it, you said it, but it was in no way an excuse for what you didn't know. So anyway, maybe we can talk about that more later, but I thought that was really beautiful. So Chad, tell us a little about you.
Well, I'm not sure when this podcast will air, but we are recording it on All Hallows Eve. Mm-hmm. That is the beginning of what's sometimes called the All Saints Triduum of All Hallows Eve, All Saints Day, and All Souls Day, or what here in Southern California we celebrate as Dia de los Muertos. Mm-hmm. And a really good time to have conversations like this about how we have been shaped by our ancestors, how we carry both their strength and the hauntings with us. And I also, since it is Halloween, I'd like to point out to listeners that Elaine and I are in costume and Ted and Darlene are not.
I was going to say that. Yeah.
Yeah. Just to paint a little picture. We're having a very serious conversation and Ched is wearing a jester's hat and still maintaining seriousness.
I don't know what kind of pants he's wearing though.
Or if.
Yeah, right, exactly. Oh,
yeah. I am a fifth generation Californian, which means dad's side, my great grandparents came in the mid 19th century when California was still part of Mexico. And that legacy has been very much a stimulation for me to try to do parallel work to the kind of work that Elaine spoke about. When I was 13, we went family camping in the central coast of Southern California, back in a beautiful undeveloped canyon called Tajiguas. I later found out that was the Hispanization of the Chumash name of Tashiwa. My dad pointed out to us kids this venerable old oak tree that had an arbor glyph on it. A picture of this arbor glyph appears in the book at the beginning of the theological interlude because it represents an important haunting for me. That the arbor glyph, the carving in the tree depicted a Franciscan padre, presumably serving communion to a Chumash neophyte, that is to say, one of the indigenous people who was forcibly brought into the mission system as a laborer and converted or imposed upon. And that image, you know, at the time we just called it the Indian tree. We didn't have any context for it, but that haunting, that picture has been on my walls, for 50 years, trying to make sense of this legacy, because that was the initial face of colonization in California, was the Franciscan mission system and the correlating Spanish takeover of the coastal land of California. That unresolved question really did stay with me. And so as a young activist in my 20s, You know, I was part of the peace movement and the anti-nuclear movement, but started had the gift of starting to work with Indigenous people around the Pacific Basin, for whom nuclear war was not a future prospect, but a present reality, because they had been displaced from their lands so that bombs could be tested, so that nuclear waste could be dumped, so that forward military bases could be established. Right, the same old pattern of colonization, of displacement, dispossession, and it was through the lens of these very traditional peoples in the Pacific Basin and Pacific Rim taught me that the violence of empire and of colonization is always first visited first and worst on Native peoples, and that that kind of broke the paradigm of the activism that I was involved in, and took me on a journey that has lasted until now of trying to figure out what our responsibility to and accountability to Indigenous peoples is when we talk, as we do in Mennonite circles often, of peace and justice. That these commitments actually have to be rooted in real histories, real places, and real covenants. So that those are a couple of the forces that brought me into this project of Healing Haunted Histories, as we try to push deeper into the psychological and spiritual, as well as the historical and political geography of decolonization. So always appreciate the opportunity to talk to other folks doing this work.
And the two of you together, was this the Healing Haunted Histories project? Was that the first real collaborative work that you did together, or had you done other things in the past?
Yeah, when we first got married, I think I was still working, teaching at Fresno Pacific University, doing short courses there.
Forgot our first date. Our first date practically was doing a workshop together at a Christian Peacemaker Team's gathering in 1997.
That is so true. Well, I thought you were going to say our first conversation. Sorry, Darlene, here we digress, but we met and Ched was brought up as a keynote speaker for a conference at Fresno Pacific, and I attended his stuff. He attended my stuff, and we recognized that we had the same analysis of violence, but had very different practices of how do we approach addressing this violence? How do we approach peacemaking? I was doing work in victim-offender dialogue and then also mediation work. Ched was very involved in nonviolent direct action. And it was actually a really powerful piece for us to come together and to name the distrust, I would almost say, between these two peacemaking camps and the hubris, I think, that exists in both camps that, prejudices towards those nonviolent direct action people. They wouldn't know what to do if folks actually wanted to have a conversation together, you know, or nonviolent direct folks, action folks, just thinking. And it's these things are true that mediators will just want to mediate everything without looking at the larger power dynamics in the room. So Darlene, you have started something here, but that was our first conversation. And then actually out of that, we've had two two book projects together. The first one was in 2009, called Ambassadors of Reconciliation, Restorative Justice and Peacemaking. Chad did four Bible studies. I interviewed contemporary practitioners in the broad spectrum of restorative justice practices. So that that first conversation in 1997.
Big deal.
So what I was starting to say when you froze completely, I mean, like, we joke a little bit about the relationship dynamics and stuff, but this podcast started with the name Define the Relationship. And I think that's often a good sort of starting point for sometimes things, to sort of locate yourself in relation to conversations, peoples, and say, okay, what, you know, let's define it from where we are so we know where we are going to move and what direction we're going to go in. So to try to transition us, it feels a little bit like, now that we have you in this conversation, the book and the work is such, like, it's dense and complex and important. There's so many layers that need to be dealt with. And we've even felt in this course so much like we're skipping over the surface and giving people a taste of questions and conversations. But we would like to start moving our focus in this course to, for lack of a better word, how we can move from, I think we've been talking a lot about truth, the truth and reconciliation. We want to, like, okay, let's understand the truth of our stories, the full truth, and how we interpret that story. And now we want, when we started, we did a red dot exercise. It's a metaphor we use, kind of like when you enter into a mall and you want to know where you are. So you find your red dot. And a lot of people came in their red dot with saying, like, I'm here because I want to move. I want to do something, action. And I think that's pretty normal for us. Maybe we were sort of reflecting, it's a bit of a colonizing sort of approach to life, that we let's take on this issue. Let's, you know, plant something and nurture it and see if we can get some a crop out of it and make something happen.
Jump in.
Yeah.
Were you going to say?
I was going to say, we had a meeting last week with a number of elders from the Roseau First Nation and a number of us talking about treaty. And one of their people, he started with, I'm tired of lip service. I just want to do something. And so felt like, okay, this is a normal and natural feeling on both parts of the conversation. So I'd like you to help us think about how to move forward into, in your restorative solidarity, wheel, which we've been working with, the making covenants and taking actions part. And, from the course, we kind of were drawn to your four R's of this piece, which is reschooling, which I feel like is a big part of what we've been doing in this course. And then, relationship building, restoration, and reparative experiments. So, I know that's a lot there. Maybe we don't want to spend as much time on the reschooling part, but if you have something important to say about that, but help us think about how we could move in a way that isn't simply a reinforcement of colonizing relationships with people, you know, where we just try to take over and fix things or whatever. Help us think through that a little bit.
Well, and maybe I'll just throw another question on top of it that we can do after this, or you can weave it in. When you talk about a discipleship of colonization, maybe that helps lead
decolonization.
Sorry. Yeah. We don't need a discipleship of colonization.
Got a lot of that already.
That was a really, discipleship is a really interesting word, because I think a lot of folks in this area kind of initially cringe at the word discipleship, because it's a bit of a loaded word, but I think, yeah, I would just like to hear you talk a bit more about that. So if you can weave those things together, you just do your magic, guys. Do your jester thing.
Yeah. Well, let's pick up on the notion, the very deeply baked in notion of white settler colonization, that we come to transform things, mm-hmm. to make them better, more productive, mm-hmm. and then to fix problems. That very managerial, very often objectifying, extractive mentality. And we really approach this work, we're really deeply impacted by 12-step cosmology. You know, the 12-step movement actually started out as part of the Oxford Revival movement in the 1930s. It started out as a Christian insurgency against various kinds of addiction. And the 12-step movement is just a really different way of approaching this work. This is not about what do I have to do to fix this, but what do we have to do to get healed, and to repair harm, which is the covenantal tradition of 12-step. So when we approach it like that, we realize A, there's no quick or easy fix, or 7 steps to firmer thighs kind of thing. It is a life work, and it is based on covenant and commitment and accountability, and it goes ever deeper. So we use the image of the onion, going 7 layers deep, and we correlate that to one of Jesus' very obscure parables about 7 demons occupying a house. This work goes as deep as we dare, in order for us to get healed. And as you all well know, in recovery work, the key question is, when we come to the point where we are asking the question, what must I do to heal? What must I do to heal? That's not fixing the other, that's repairing the root of the problem. So this book is, it's long, it's dense, but so is recovery work. So is the work that scripture calls repentance. But the word repent means to turn around, and it means to turn around not only one's personal history, but one's political history. And that's a huge task. It's an intergenerational task. It's an intrapsychic task. And it is, and we use the term discipleship because it is about discipline. It's about following a committed way to healing. It's not about a kind of one magical fix and we're done. And of course, that's still a contested notion in our faith tradition. There's a lot of resistance to doing deep and ongoing work and to seeing faith as a healing path as opposed to a get out of jail free card. Mm-hmm. So out of that general orientation came our attempt to kind of distill 4 aspects to the recovery work. It's not a ladder that you go from step to step. It's work that you keep doing around in a circle. Mm-hmm. And that does start with reschooling, because we have been so much of what we embrace personally and politically is based on devised and dismembered narratives about self and society, about our history. And so it's exceedingly important that we curate spaces where we together can do this work, because this work does not happen naturally in any venue in our society. It doesn't happen on television. It doesn't happen on the 6 o'clock news. It doesn't happen in our school systems. We would love to believe it could happen in our churches, but that's a matter of reconstruction. So that's kind of a beginning place, is to start re-narrating, re-analyzing, re-understanding. So we call that re-schooling.
Mm-hmm. And I want to jump back just a bit about our understanding of a discipleship of decolonization, because I do think many of us were raised in a church where we understood that discipleship was my relationship with God, and it was a one-way path. That was all that was worried about, was a covenant with God. The biblical understanding of covenant includes the land, includes the community, and of course includes a relationship with God. And so when we think about a biblical understanding of covenant, that is how we are thinking about a discipleship of decolonization. What is our relationship to the land? What is our covenant? What are our promises to this land? And so we're doing that work in terms of landlines and bloodlines. What is our responsibility to the people who are our direct neighbors and our community? And then songlines of that bloodlines. And then songlines, of course, mm-hmm. is the inspiration and the relationship and our promises to God as people that are entangled in the story and impact of colonization. That's another way that I think of this discipleship of decolonization, why we take the approach of learning how our ancestors and how we are subjects of colonization. That is our attempt to try to fight against the tendency to think that colonization is not about us. It's too complicated. It happened years ago. Like, that's just not our responsibility. Part of our discipleship of decolonization is to do our own work about how our ancestors and thus how we are entangled in colonization. So I wanted to noodle that out a little bit. And so, when we talk about reschooling, which is the work that you are doing, but other ways that people are working on it, a very profound way for me was to take a trip to Ukraine. All four of my grandparents, two from Ukraine and two from Russia. So to be on that land, to understand the political, social, cultural happenings of that place, why the Russian Revolution bubbled up, how we had displaced indigenous peoples there in the 1780s, the Nogai and Cossacks. There's all sorts of research on that. That was a part of my reschooling, and is really, the first step in doing this decolonization work. But then we keep going around this circle of the four steps of restorative solidarity as well.
We talk about part of reschooling as pilgrimages of pedagogy, in which we are very intentional about moving into spaces that are outside of our comfort zone in order to learn in our bodies. And, you know, the last couple of summers in Saskatchewan, we've accompanied folks onto some local reserves to do work on this material in that space. And it's astonishing to us how many white settlers have never actually been to a reserve. And so, you know, moving, learning history by tracing landlines into spaces. And that obviously raises then the second aspect, which is building relationships with people who have been invisibilized and objectified. You know, there's, as we all know, there's no better way to uncover our hidden prejudices than to come into relationship where suddenly we're working full time to truly encounter another person outside of these filters that we were all socialized with. So the relationship piece, Elder Harry LaFond really emphasizes there's no movement without relationship. There's no change. And the danger, again, of white settlers is to stay in our safety zone and try to just work on ourselves. And actually, the real work happens when we, when we're in deep engagement with folks who are going to challenge us and surprise us and help heal us. And when relationships have been established, and as we do this ongoing reschooling of our consciousness and our competences, then we can move into the real work of decolonization, which is about experiments in restoration, restorative justice, and repair. And that is where we can work both individually and communally and politically to try to start changing these things.
Can you give us an example of some experiments that either you've been a part of or that begin to, like, and when you say experiment, I think that word is, I'm assuming you use that word really intentionally, as in this isn't this is truly an experiment.
It's not a strategic plan.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
I'm just curious about what, if you can share a story or.
Yeah. What comes to mind immediately is there are really wonderful efforts that are happening all over, I think, US and Canada, about communities in consultation, working with local Indigenous folks, are developing a voluntary tax program or a, I know in Northwest it's called Real Rent, and it looks at, we are living on Indigenous land, our homes, in our churches, our farmland, and what I always want to say is it is not just farmland. It's not the acres and acres of land. It's also, my house is on Chumash territory. It's in Chumash territory. What is my responsibility to that? We pay taxes all the time to the state and to the feds. How do we pay or acknowledge that we're living on Indigenous land? So there's all sorts of really good experiments where folks have developed. You go online, you put in your in a certain city that have these programs set up. How big is your house? How many bedrooms does it have? There's different things like that. Is it, you know, do you own it or are you also paying rent there? And there is a suggestion of the annual or monthly donation you can give to the local band. And yeah, many communities are have this set up. One of the interesting pieces, I mean, we've been talking about that for a long time here in Chumash land, and it is not coming together yet. And that's why we call it an experiment. Mm-hmm. It is, folks are not ready to figure out how to receive that money. So we are waiting. Our rent is growing. It's building up, and we will, when it is time, we will be able to give that there.
So it's the idea of a voluntary civil tax that acknowledges that we need to start thinking of ways to redistribute resources, financial, real estate, capacity. And these are ways in which people can begin now doing stuff that they decide how much they do. And it has begun to build some capacity of indigenous organizations. For example, Sogorete in the San Francisco Bay Area is a cultural movement that I think 15 years ago instituted the tax, and it's really built up the movement. And we were just on a Zoom program yesterday in which Sogorete now not only is reviving Ohlone cultural practices, they've established a land, they're working on the repatriation of remains, a lot of really basic stuff that is about engaging and repairing the past. But they have now partnered with some of the most dynamic indigenous leadership way in Northern California to figure out how to actually purchase land that comes up for sale and put it in trust for a tribe that has been, is not federally recognized, has been completely dispossessed, and is starting to rebuild a land base. And these are experiments because they haven't been done before. And and we learn as we go from what works and what doesn't work. But that's part of the learning, and it's part of the healing. So that's one vector of, and we like to talk about that because it's both personal and it's political. But taxes are a collective attempt to redistribute resources that, you know, has a long history in our societies. And so it allows that personal engagement, but also has a more public aspect to it.
And I just wanted to add what is really wonderful, and we just learned about this yesterday, is that a Catholic worker community actually made that possible. A religious organization, no, it's a church that doesn't have to deal with the property taxes, which, you know, this is 1,100 acres of land, and the Winnemucca tribe paying those taxes every year, they would not, the fear is they would lose the land. And so they really, like, they were dealing with real estate attorneys and all sorts of processes to figure out how to get this land. The fundraising was huge, but then also how are they going to be able to keep this land? And so now they've set up through the, somehow it's through
partnership,
the
partnership of fiscal sponsorship.
Yeah. The Catholic Worker Church. So yeah, it's exciting. These things are really happening. And they're happening all over Turtle Island, settlers and indigenous folks, settlers supporting, the work that indigenous folks want to do.
We, in our work, we like to talk about no step being too small. Every little change matters, but also no step is too big because we're tackling such a huge legacy. and so nothing in and of itself is going to be the big easy fix, but all these small changes. We love to show this image of loonies and toonies on a table, you know, and it's labeled, you know, small change. Small change matters because it contributes to moving the needle and moving and turning history around.
Yeah, I mean, it reminds me a little bit of some, like, things that have started to bubble up in our community. Obviously, the reschooling has been important because it's giving people a different perspective on what we're dealing with in our world right now. And so when you have that different perspective, it makes you ask things like, well, I need to get to know that person, or we have this community close by. Let's get closer to them and let's learn from them. somebody in our class who is a school principal talked about how the vice principal of the Indigenous school on reserve, she talked about, well, she's mentoring me, is how this principal talked about a relationship. And because of those kind of conversations, we've started asking questions like, well, what would it look like for us to do something reparative experimentally? And the big obstacle, I think, for us is not, well, where would money come from? That's not the issue. The issue is, where would it get directed that it would actually not do more harm than that it would actually would connect in with what a community is wanting to do and help them? And then because of relationships, we started to see some possibilities. And one was this vice principal saying, you know, our biggest issue right now in our First Nation is the loss of the elders and the language that's going with those elders. And she simply said, we need your help, not just finances, but your best practices around language and learning. And so there was sort of like, immediately there was like this opportunity that came out where, because of relationship, the community people are saying, this is what we need. Can you help us? And then it feels a lot more possible, because it's not us kind of bulldozing in and saying, hey, here's your biggest issues. Let us help you fix your biggest issues. They're saying, this is our big issue. Help. Yep. And so, yeah, it's so interesting how those things only come out of the reschooling and the relationship building. They don't come before that.
But even that is filled with a lot of kind of complexity and tension, because this Indigenous person saying, help us with your best practices from a Western perspective. My first thought is that a colonized request? Like, right? Do they really need our help with that? Talking with other local pastors, and there's a request also to go to a Northern Indian reservation and bring DVBS. There's relationship there. And they would like the church on the reserve wants this church here to come there and bring DVBS. And I asked the question, like, should we be doing that? Like, even if they're asking, are they just asking because they've been colonized as well? This is one of the things I'm learning from some of my Indigenous friends, is like, oh yeah, we don't know any other. We're asking this because we don't know any other way to do it either. We're not in touch with our own traditions, with our own practices, with our own ways. So it's still even the requests feel very fraught for me. Like, should we be doing this? But maybe if it's an experiment, you know, it's kind of like, well, how could we do this in such a way that it's collaborative or healing for all?
But, you know, doing oral histories, archiving living language before it dies, bringing linguistic technology to preserve and to promote, these are things that can help in the effort to either preserve or revive languages. And that's one of the key issues in decolonization, is the reconstruction of culture. Will there be missteps? Will there be misunderstandings? Will it be partial and complex? Yes. That's something that settlers need to get used to, is living with the questions and the complexity and staying in the room, staying in the in the struggle, even when things go sideways, because that's part of the process. No clicktivism, no easy answers, just continuing the relationship building.
Thanks for teaching me a new word. I like that one. Quicktivism. That's awesome.
you know what we're talking about there.
Yeah.
So that, again, that's why we come back to the word discipleship. This is work, and it's staying at it. Mm. It's intergenerational. It's not a fad. It's not the latest, coolest thing that will be replaced with some other latest, coolest thing. And you know, that's the cultural underbrush and undertow that we're constantly having to deal with to invite folk in and be together and sustain each other in the long haul of this work. Mm-hmm. And you know, our tradition has a great word for it, and that's discipleship.
Mm-hmm. That's really helpful. I appreciate that.
Well, we thank you very much for the time that you spent with us.
We got in just under a half hour, right?
Yeah, well, we're not counting bathroom breaks and internet catastrophe. We really appreciate the time that you spent with us, kind of priming the pump for us. And we are very much looking forward to our community seeing your faces on the screen and hearing some teaching and some thought-provoking questions for us to continue to guide the work that it's not limited to this 5-session course, but something that we're hopefully getting people ready to kind of make it a lifelong journey. Thanks so much, folks.
May this week bring us, help us listen to the stories of saints and to the voices of ancestors, so that we can help repair not only our present, but our past as well as our future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thanks so much.
Yeah. Look very forward to meeting everybody on Sunday.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very early for you. Maybe Ched, you could wear the hat because you know you should be there with bells on, I believe is the saying.
That's good.